What up, Canes fans? Before we get started, just wanted to talk to you guys about the Tank Brewery real quick. The Tank is located in the heart of Miami in Dade County at 5100 Northwest 72nd Avenue. This place is awesome. I've been there. The beer is outstanding. The food is great. Whether you're watching the Canes game, the Heat game there with your buddies, you're having a guys' night out, or you're having a date night with the missus, it's a great place to hang out. So you can order online at thetankbrewingtakeout.com or call them at 786-801-1554 for delivery or pickup. And here's the thing. If you use the promo code TANK4SUP, you will get free delivery on game days. And so that is TANK4SUP, the number four. Not spell it out, but TANK4SUP. So go check out our friends at the Tank Brewing. They've been great to us. So take it away, Jordan.
All right. Also, we want you guys to check out our guy, Stickers by AB. That's at STICKERZ by AB. You know, I've been ordering a bunch of stuff from him. You know, we have a collaboration sticker that has our logo on it. So make sure you're checking him out. Give him a follow on Twitter. He's just a good dude, and he's helping us design our merch. So yeah, man, it's make sure you're supporting the good people that help us out here on Fours Up.
You're listening to the Fours Up podcast with your host Marsh.
Good afternoon, Canes fans. It is the Fours Up podcast. It is Thursday, November 5th. It is game day eve. It's your boy Marsh reporting live from South Florida. And as always, I am joined by my wonderful producer and co-host, Jordan Nelson. Jordan, talk to me. How are we feeling? We got a game tomorrow. What are we saying?
Vibing, dude. I got my watermelon monster right here.
I tried it.
Yeah, it's how good is it? It's amazing,
it's very,
right?
It's very, very good. I had one this morning, and I'm still just jumping off the walls.
Yeah, man, I'm just I'm nursing this bad boy.
but big game tomorrow. It feels like we have not played in a year.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it does.
Honestly, with everything going on, sorry to cut you off, but like with everything going on in our country and all this shit. It like I need Canes football.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't just need Canes football. I need a W.
Dude, I need my Twitter account to be suspended or something. That's what I
need. Bro, I don't Twitter in the last few days, man. Oh,
I just need to delete that app off my phone. No, I mean not really, but you guys know what I mean.
Yeah, it's been just a crazy insane week, as you all know, you know, with little thing called this election. And yeah. But I'm just ready for the game tomorrow. The only thing that sucks is that I'm getting used to this Eastern time zone. And like, for instance, today, you know, the Packers are playing the Niners at 8:30.
Dude, that's stupid.
8:30. I'm going to watch the first quarter and then I'm like, all right, guys, I'm retiring.
And time to pack it in.
Time to hit the hay.
Yeah, dude. I honestly think Mountain Time Zone is the best for sports.
Oh,
you know, because there's nothing better. Yeah, like on Sunday, I roll out of bed at like 10:30, so I got to sleep in. I'm all refreshed and recharged, and then by the time I get my pajamas on and eat like a PB&J or something, then the 11 o'clock games are starting. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's yeah, like friggin' this past Sunday, I had to wait till 1 o'clock.
Oh my gosh, it sounds terrible.
It's horrible. Like my whole day is shot.
I know, dude.
It's terrible. It's terrible. But we have a special guest coming on first. Kind of, it's not a Canes guy, but it's a football guy. But before we get to that, Jordan, you want to talk to him about AB?
Oh yeah, yeah. Make sure you guys are checking out Stickers by AB. He's our guy. You know, I have some stickers actually in the mail right now, headed towards my place. You know, and make sure you guys are using the Fours Up promotion code. That is the number 4 SUP, and that'll give you 15% off of any of your orders. But yeah, make sure you check out his website. He's a big friend of the podcast. You know, he's helping us design our merch whenever that comes out. And yeah, so shout out to AB and stickers by AB. So
absolutely. Okay, what do you say we get this going with our first guest?
Absolutely. Hello.
Oh.
Jeff, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. So we now welcome on author Jeff Benedict. He just wrote probably my new favorite football book titled The Dynasty. Goes in depth about the run that the New England Patriots have been on, you know, from 2001 to this past year. And as you all know, I am a huge, huge fan of Coach Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. So, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. So let's get right into it. What made you want to write this book about the Patriots and get involved with this team?
You know, I had just finished writing Tiger Woods' biography. And before that, I had done a autobiography on Steve Young. And I'm interested in people and organizations that are the best in the world at what they do. And to me, the Patriots has been the best sports franchise in America this century. And when I say this century, I mean since 2000. And I just was curious, like, how did they build this dynasty? How did they build the machine? And then secondly, how did they maintain it for so long? Because there's no dynasty in football that has lasted as long as this one. The Packers in the 60s, the Steelers in the 70s, and the 49ers in the 80s and early 90s, none of them were able to sustain the excellence as long as this organization. So for me, it was just great curiosity about how did they do it?
Yeah. And I'm the same way. I'm just, you know, I'm not a Patriots fan, but I became a Bill Belichick fan as I started to write about football and become more, you know, interested in the sport and interested in what drives these winning organizations. So, I mean, the Patriots dynasty had started in 2001, basically when, you know, they're coming off a 5-11 season, but they just signed Drew Bledsoe to, you know, this big contract. He gets hurt, you know, when they play the Jets, and here comes Tom Brady. How did Bill Belichick turn this into a winning organization? I mean, because when Tom Brady took over, the Patriots were 0-2 at the time. What do you think was the key component in getting the 2001 season started, and which eventually ended in that Super Bowl championship?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to go back to. Number one, when Belichick came to New England in 2000, he wasn't necessarily crazy about Drew Bledsoe. Bledsoe was a superstar quarterback, and after Belichick's first year, Robert Kraft awarded Bledsoe with the highest salary in the NFL, $103 million contract, which was a 10-year deal that would have kept Drew in New England until 2010. Think about that. 2010, Drew Bledsoe would have still been the quarterback. And so that tells you how Kraft felt about and the organization felt about Bledsoe. But Belichick wasn't as crazy about Bledsoe. When he drafted Brady in 2000, it wasn't because he thought he was this incredible, he was going to be this great superstar. But I think he saw things in Brady that no one else saw. And by the start of the 2001 season, so going into Brady's second year, after that training camp, Belichick was convinced that Brady was the ideal quarterback to start for the Patriots, but he couldn't do that because he had the superstar there that was making all this money. So when the injury happens to Bledsoe a couple weeks into that season, it's an opportunity for Tom to step in and to play. And he performed extremely well under the circumstances. And I think it made it easier, much easier for Belichick to stick with him once Bledsoe was cleared to return medically and play later that year. And I think what's so important here for people to realize is the great debate about who's more important to the dynasty. Was it Belichick or was it Brady? I think what is apparent is that it's both of them. In other words, neither one of them, I think, would have had the success level that they had in New England without each other. And I think without the ownership of Kraft. Kraft is that third leg of the stool that never gets talked about. And I can say more about that later. But I think here, what you see is that it's not just Belichick's system. It's the fact that it's his system in the hands of the greatest quarterback that's ever played the game. I mean, and that's the part about Brady that's so intriguing, is that he bought fully into the idea that in the NFL, a lot of games are lost by mistakes that players make, self-forced errors. And Brady was different than Bledsoe in the sense that he wasn't a gunslinger. He is not a high risk taker. And he understood early on the importance of avoiding the sack, throwing the interception, trying to force things that weren't there. And so often the Patriots would not beat themselves, and they would capitalize on the mistakes that other teams made that enabled the Patriots to beat them. And I think that was Brady was so mature in that sense that he was understanding and buying into this philosophy of Belichick's at a very early age. He didn't learn it when he was 30. He learned it when he was a rookie.
So I do want you to go a little more into Brady, if you would. And the reason why is because I've always had a hard time understanding the mental and emotional makeup of Tom Brady. You know, he doesn't have this, well, at least from the surface, it doesn't appear that he has the same type of like killer instinct that a guy like Michael Jordan or Kobe Bryant does. You know, it's not visual as much as other characters in sports. And he's never really, I mean, I guess I've never considered him an elite physical specimen. You know, it's not like he has the biggest arm. He's not overly athletic. And also, you know, he never came off as Peyton Manning, you know, as the field general type of stuff. So if you wouldn't mind explaining how Tom Brady kind of didn't really have any of these classical components that we view, at least on the surface level, and has turned his career into, like you said, probably the greatest career in NFL history for a quarterback.
So I would actually say, you know, not to be argumentative, but I would actually disagree with you on the things you just said. First of all, I think he is absolutely possesses the same killer instinct mentality that you say Jordan and Kobe have. And by the way, I agree that they have that. He plays a different sport. He has a helmet on, you know,
okay. That's a great point.
secondly, football is a game that is watched from a distance. Basketball is a game that is watched from intimate, close proximity. When you go to a basketball game and you sit courtside, you can see the sweat dripping from Jordan's chin. You can hear everything that he says to his opponents, the taunts, the trash talking. You can see the whites of his eyes when he's glaring at an opponent. When you go to a football game, you can't hear anything that Tom Brady is saying on the field. You can't hear the things that he screams at Ray Lewis in the bottom of the pile when Lewis is on top of him. And they're shouting F-bombs at each other and screaming. There's so much that you can't see and feel in an NFL game. But if you talk to the players who compete alongside Tom and compete against Tom, I think to a man, the defensive players that play for the Ravens and the Jets and the Giants, and they'll all tell you he has lethal killer instinct. He has this, it's the exact opposite of what he possesses when he is not between the lines. Tom is a very buttoned up, quiet, almost meek kind of guy when you see him not in his uniform. But the minute he puts on his uniform and steps on the field, he is a very different human being. And there's like nobody, I think, in the NFL that possesses the desire, the drive to do what it takes to win like him. So that's the first thing. The second thing, when you talk about the physical specimen and the athleticism and all that, here's what I would say. I don't think there's anybody in football that is as physically determined to win than him. At 43 years old, he possesses a level of fitness and immunity to injury that's unparalleled in the 100-year history of the NFL. There's simply nobody we can point to in the history of the game, and that's a huge thing to say. In 100 years of professional football, there is no athlete ever who we can point to and say has been able to perform at an elite level in the most physically violent team sport we have in America than Tom Brady. At 43, he is doing things that no one else has ever done. And when you look at players, I don't care if it's Cam Newton, Patrick Mahomes, RG3, think of all the quarterbacks that have come into the league in the last 15 years who were extremely athletic, had great arm strength, great speed with their legs. How many of them have survived and been able to keep going? And that's the thing is, he's the outlier of all these things. We can call Peyton Manning the great field general, but at the bottom line is, how many rings does Peyton have? I mean, I think that that's the thing is, Peyton Manning, for most of his career, had a receiving core and a running back core that were far superior to Tom Brady's. Not every year. I'm not talking about 2007 when Brady had Welker and Moss and Dante Stallworth in the lineup. Sure, that year he had better weapons. But most years, if you go 2007 backwards, I would say Peyton Manning had better weapons every year than Tom Brady.
Yeah.
And so the thing is, Tom is in many ways, like, to me, he is the ultimate football player. He is physically figured out how to dominate and survive in a sport where the average lifespan of a football player is under 3 years. And he's now, you know, past 20. And so I think that there's a lot of things about him. And that's one of the things in the dynasty that I was so intrigued to write about and understand is, how has he done that? Because I think that's one of the things that has been perplexing to Bill Belichick in the last half of the dynasty, the second half, meaning from 2010 on. I think Belichick kept expecting and thinking that Tom would slow down, that he would get hurt, that his career would finally end. And it just kept going and going and going. And now it's going in Tampa Bay.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so, I mean, my biggest – what I love most about, you know, the Patriots and Coach Bill Belichick is the culture of winning that he has created in New England. And, you know, this is a University of Miami Hurricanes podcast, and that's something – you know, building a winning culture is something that has been stressed a lot at UM because we're trying to get back to our winning ways. And you've seen that Nick Saban was able to do that. You know, obviously he coached with Belichick in Cleveland. How, sure. What goes into building a winning culture in an organization like that, that, you know, goes on for 10 plus years?
It's a great question. And I think that one of the things, obviously there's a big difference between college and pro and what, you know, what's happening at Alabama now with Nick Saban. He has to do different things because the player personnel is literally changing every year or every 4 years. You have a completely new team. But in New England, I think what has greatly enabled Belichick to build the culture that he has built there is there are two things. One is he has an owner who understands and trusts him as a coach. And that owner, Robert Kraft, has given Bill Belichick two things. One is he's given him control. In other words, he has the room and the ability to make decisions and then live with those decisions. In other words, Kraft doesn't run the Patriots the way Jerry Jones runs the Cowboys. He has chosen a coach that he thinks is the best coach, and then he's equipped him by giving him basically the jurisdiction to go out and do his job. The second thing that Belichick has that has enabled him to get to the top and stay there is he had a player for 20 years, Brady, the leader, the quarterback, who fully bought into the culture. And so when Tom Brady becomes the star, wins three Super Bowls in his first 4 years as a starter, and the Patriots are a dynasty by 2005, at that point, Brady is, he's the star of the league. He's the brightest star in the NFL. But at that point is when he fully buys into the idea that Belichick is going to continue to treat him as if he's just another player. He's still going to refer to him as Johnny effing Foxborough, and he's going to yell at him in the film room when the whole team is there and they're watching film of last night's game and Brady throws a bad pass and Belichick undresses him in front of the whole team. How does Brady respond to that? And I think when you consider how Randy Moss and Dante Stallworth, one of my favorite scenes in the dynasty is their first meeting as Patriots in 2007, when they show up as basically free agents who have come to New England. When they go to that first team meeting and Belichick is showing film of Brady and criticizing him in front of the whole team, and Moss is looking at Dante going, what in the world did we just sign up for? Like, they can't believe, A, that Belichick is doing that to Brady, but even more importantly, that Brady's taking it. And as Moss explained, when you see the quarterback of Tom Brady's caliber enduring that kind of criticism in front of his peers, you know right then you better get in line behind Brady. And you better do your job, because if he's putting up with this, we certainly have to put up with this. And I think that's like a secret sauce to the Patriots' success that people don't understand, is Brady was so instrumental in getting everybody else to buy in and accept the rigorous coaching mentality of Bill Belichick. So to go back to your point about Peyton Manning, if you want to compare Manning and Brady, you have to ask yourself, could or would Peyton Manning or Aaron Rodgers or Brett Favre or any of these other quarterbacks, Dan Marino, that we consider the greatest of the greats, do you really think that any of them would have put up with what Brady put up with for 20 years? The answer is no. It's no. There isn't another star quarterback, and I'm talking about the elite guys now, the Peyton Mannings of the world, the Aaron Rodgers, that would have done what Brady did, that would have endured that. And that is so critical to understanding the mentality of, this is why Rob Gronkowski and Julian Edelman and Wes Welker and Danny Amendola and Vince Wilfork and Ninkovich, and just go right down the line, all of those guys bought into it because the leader was buying into it.
I love that. I mean, I love this kind of stuff. I love this kind of stuff. One of the questions I had, so in 2007, you know, the Patriots had already won three Super Bowls by that time. In 2007, obviously, they go for the perfect season but are upset by the Giants. What do you think Belichick learned from that loss to, you know, go forward with that organization to win several more Super Bowls in the future?
Well, I think that Belichick is better than anyone in the ranks of coaching at using losses, losing setbacks, as instruments of teaching and learning. He is the master at that. And so those kinds of losses are soul-crushing losses. There are very few players, coaches, organizations that could survive that kind of loss that the Giants handed the Patriots. It's hard to fathom being 18-0, being perfect, like literally perfect, and being ahead in the Super Bowl, being moments away from being 19-0, running the table, and knowing that this is a team they've already beaten in New York. And then to lose the way they did with that unbelievable play, the catch that just, you know, seemed so improbable. When you lose that kind of game that way, most people would not recover from that. And so the fact that the Patriots, they didn't start trading guys. They didn't get rid of players. they came back in 2008 and said, look, we're going to come back. We're going to start all over, because that's what you do with every football season. It's starting all over. We're 0-0. You know, we're coming out of training camp 0-0, and we're going to start that long climb and get right back to that game again. And we saw what happened, right? The first game of that season, Tom Brady blows his knee out, and they lose him for the whole year. And so did that stop them? No. I mean, and that's the thing that's remarkable, is Belichick and Brady together, and this is why I would unify them when I say this, these are two individuals that are capable of coming back season after season with the same mentality and desire to win. Like, it's why I think Tom has played for over 20 years. He said it last week to Randy Moss. There is nothing he would rather do in the world than win football games. And if you talk to Bill Belichick, there is nothing he would rather do in the world than win football games. There just aren't many human beings that are wired like that. And so I think the genius of Robert Kraft, to take it back to him as the owner, is I think he recognized very early on in this dynasty and that he had Paul McCartney and John Lennon on his payroll. In other words, and that's how I compare them in the dynasty in the book, is that I compare Belichick and Brady to Lennon and McCartney, because I think there is a parallel there. Like, you're never going to see another Beatles. There'll never be another band that will be like them. There have been thousands of bands that started out wanting to be the next Beatles, but the reason no one's been able to do it is because there is no other John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And I think that's what Kraft saw in Belichick and Brady. He knew that you're never going to see another coach and a quarterback like those two guys. So the whole trick is, how do I keep them on the same stage for 20 years, right? Don't let them break up the way the Beatles did prematurely. And I think that's why I think you can't underestimate the importance of the owner in this whole discussion. He submerged his ego to put the two stars front and center, shine the bright light on them, and then keep them in that light for 20 years.
Well, so I actually have a lot of questions. You're giving us some really good stuff, so I really appreciate it. Would you mind going deeper into that stuff with Robert Kraft? Because that's really interesting to me. And I think it's becoming more interesting now that Brady and Belichick like broke up essentially, right? That they yes. split and they're not together anymore. So if you wouldn't mind going into more detail about the actions that Robert Kraft took specifically to kind of manage this relationship. And then later I do want to ask you more about their specific relationship and you know, what happened in the off season. But for sure. Now, if you wouldn't mind telling us what Robert Kraft did to keep them together.
Absolutely. I think one of the best interviews I did for this book was with Rupert Murdoch, the chairman of News Corp and Fox News and all that. Obviously, Fox has the huge NFC television contract. And so he has dealt with Robert Kraft for a long time, 20 years. And he knows him very, very well. And in the interview that I did with Murdoch for the book, one of the things he said to me was, he said, if Robert Kraft had gone into politics, he probably would have gone down in American history as one of the country's greatest diplomats. But he didn't go into politics. He went into sports. And in sports, he has used those skills as a diplomat that he possesses to keep Tom Brady and Bill Belichick together for so much longer than anyone else would have been able to keep them together. And one of the ways he did that was that he formed two different relationships with the two men, because they're very different men. In the case of Brady, he formed a familial relationship. In other words, it's more like a father and a son. Tom has a great relationship with his father, so it's not like he needed a father figure. But he saw in Robert Kraft a fatherly-like figure, and Robert always saw in Tom, he treated Tom like his fifth son. There's a really important thing that happens around the 2007-2008 time period, that's when Brady has really kind of – he's reaching that level of stardom that's unsurpassed in the NFL. And Robert takes Brady to Israel. He takes him on a trip to Israel with his wife, Myra. At that point, keep in mind, Brady's still a single guy. He's not married yet. He doesn't have a family yet. They go to Israel together, and they spend a week over there. And this is an incredible environment to start deepening the personal relationship that the two of them have. It becomes very important a few years later in 2010 when Brady's contract is expiring. He's now been a Patriot for a decade. He's gone through a serious knee injury, reconstructive surgery, and he's getting to the point in his career where if you look at the other great quarterbacks, Joe Montana, John Elway, Dan Marino, Steve Young, Brett Favre, he's on that trajectory, but he's getting older. And now you know at this point that the actuary charts are telling you that he only has a few years left in his prime. And he also knows that you look at Bill Belichick's track record over the years, as players get up in age and their salaries have become so much larger, Lawyer Malloy, Ty Law, Willie McGinnis, Adam Vinatieri, right? We know the list. It's a heck of a list. He jettisons those players as they get to that point in their career. And this is where they have this big summit on Cape Cod where Kraft has a summer home. He brings Brady up there, and they come to an agreement that they would not have been able to come to if they didn't have the familial relationship they had. In other words, this isn't a written contract. This is a gentleman's agreement that's made by looking each other in the eye and understanding that Robert Kraft is essentially going to protect Tom Brady. And this is really important to opening the door for Brady to remain in New England for another decade. I think when you read the book, you see that it would have been very possible, likely, and understandable for Brady to leave New England sometime around 2010 or shortly thereafter. And had he done that, he would have followed the path of Joe Montana. It would have been like almost exactly like what Joe did. So Kraft's relationship with Brady is what keeps Brady in New England for what would be basically the second half of the dynasty that produces three more Super Bowls beyond what they already had. And then the relationship that Kraft has with Belichick is the ultimate owner-coach relationship. It's unlike, if you look at Jerry Jones, for example, and the relationships he's had with coaches, or you could look at actually any other owner you want to look at, you can't find one that has nurtured the kind of efficiency and trust and reciprocity that exists between Belichick and Kraft. And that's been so instrumental to allowing Belichick to be who he is. He has moved on from a lot of players that an owner might emotionally want to keep in New England, but Kraft gives him the ability, the room to make those calls and then support his coach. I think that that's why the success formula has been what it's been for the last 20 years.
So one of the coolest things about Belichick and one of the things that I respect most about him is that he approaches each game, you know, with a one game mentality. I mean, you've heard the famous quote, "We're on to Cincinnati," and you know, one 2 year job. And as a Hurricanes fan, and also as a Dallas Cowboy fan, expectations at the beginning of the season are always, you know, championship or bust. We're always looking towards the postseason. And one of the things that I admire about Belichick is that mentality, just taking it one game at a time. How do you think that has affected the organization and his players for the better over time?
So On to Cincinnati is obviously one of the chapters in the book. And, you know, there's a great story in that chapter about after the Patriots got just destroyed by the Kansas City Chiefs on Monday Night Football. And everyone was writing them off and saying not only is this season a bust, but the dynasty is finally over. Brady's finished. The team is not going to be good. Blah, 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 blah. And Rob Gronkowski, I'll never forget this because this was an interview I did with Gronkowski at his home. And he was explaining what was going on in the locker room after that game. And I don't mean moments after the game, but in the days after that loss to Kansas City, where Bill Belichick's performance in the press conference, where he deflected every single question about Tom Brady's age and whether he was losing it and all this stuff, the answer to every time was, we're on to Cincinnati, we're on to Cincinnati, we're on to Cincinnati. And what Gronkowski was explaining was, as a player in the locker room, that was a tremendous lesson to the players, but also a tremendous coaching feat by Belichick, because what it enabled all the players to do was to say to themselves, like, we don't need to focus on Kansas City. We need to focus on Cincinnati. We need to all focus on next week. And if the coach is focused on next week, we're just going to go with him. And we all know what happened to Cincinnati. The Patriots destroyed Cincinnati. And that game was the launch pad for an incredible run that they went on that year, that they ran it all the way to the Super Bowl. And I think that is the kind of thing that Belichick teaches by example, right? It's like another great story, one of my favorite stories in the book. This would go way back to when Brady was in his first year as a starter. So 2001, when they lose a game that they shouldn't have lost, and everybody knows it, and then they show up for practice, the first practice they had after that game, Belichick had dug a hole in the practice field, literally a hole in the ground, a bunch of dirt piled up next to it, like you would see in a cemetery when you dig a grave. And when the players arrived at the field, he had them all gather around, and then he put a football in the hole, and then he buried it with dirt. You know, he had a shovel, and he buried the football. It was like having a funeral for the game they had just lost, telling everybody in a very visual way, that is dead. It's behind us. And there was no one that had a bigger impact on than Tom Brady. As a young first-year starter, that lesson that was taught to him very early on, which was, when the game is over, it's over. Like, whether you win by 100 points or lose by 100 points, it doesn't matter. It's done. Like, what matters is tomorrow. And I think the reason you know that mentality works is because if you look over the history of the dynasty, after every Super Bowl that they go to, what do you see Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski and Julian Edelman talking about? They're talking about next year. They're talking about, like, that Super Bowl it doesn't really matter anymore. What matters is what we do next year. It's really hard to get players to adopt or adapt that mentality, because that's so exhausting. Like, if you think about it, you tell someone for a whole year, the goal is to get to the top of the mountain. So you do everything you have to do to get there. And then as soon as you get there, you're like, wow, this was great. And then the helicopter comes and picks you up and takes you down to the bottom to give you the trophy. And then the coach says, okay, starting tomorrow, it's all about getting back to the top of the mountain. Well, most people would go, excuse me, can we just relax a little bit and enjoy this and, you know, rest on our laurels a little bit? Well, in New England, they don't do that. And so it's a rare breed of players that are able to endure that kind of mentality. But that's Bill Belichick's mentality.
Wow. Well, so I guess one of the questions that I mentioned earlier, and I guess you touched on a little bit about the relationship between Bill and Tom Brady.
Yes.
So now that they've broken up, I was very interested to read, you know, Rob Gronkowski's comments on coming back to the NFL, where he said, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to, you know, say it totally the wrong way, but essentially that, like, he made it sound like New England stopped being fun for him, and so he quit football, and he was, you know, looking forward to play again in a new situation. I mean, I'm more of a basketball guy.
But I couldn't help but make parallels to what Kevin Love said about playing with LeBron James, you know, where he's like, is it the funnest thing to do? No, but you're guaranteed a spot in the NBA Finals if you do it. So a lot of us, you know, like it's the trade-off that you make. And I'm wondering if that's kind of what it's like playing for Bill Belichick, and that's the sacrifice that these guys have been making to have this much success.
Well, I think one of the themes that you see in the narrative, it wasn't hard for me to think about how to structure this in the book, because what I was seeing is great player after great player that's come through New England. You know, it is Lawyer Malloy, it is Ty Law and Willie McGinnis and Teddy Bruschi and Randy Moss and Wes Welker and, you know, Ninkovich. And you just keep going through these guys. And then it becomes Edelman and Gronkowski and the next wave. There is a it's tiring. It's physically, mentally and emotionally exhausting to play with or for somebody who is the best in the world at what they do. So LeBron is that. Tom Brady is that. Bill Belichick is that. And so there's a scene in the book where Gronkowski is a rookie and he is so frustrated and worn down by the demands that Tom Brady is putting on him in training camp and in practice that he is literally ready to punch Brady in the face. he literally is at the end of his rope because Brady is, you know, relentlessly yelling at him in practice and relentlessly, you know, sort of criticizing him. And I remember asking Gronkowski, how is Belichick in all of this? And he said Belichick loved it because Brady is doing basically Belichick's job for him. Like Belichick doesn't have to browbeat Gronkowski because Tom's doing it. So Bill's all for it. He likes that Tom is pushing Gronkowski to the brink. And the thing is, and this is, I think, what separates the great players, and Gronkowski is a great player. He's going to go down in history as, if not the greatest tight end who's ever played, he's in the conversation as one of three, right? He's right there. Yeah. And so not every tight end could withstand the withering criticism and intensity of Tom Brady. Just not everybody's made for that.
Yeah.
But Gronkowski eventually buys into it and understands it and learns that by playing with Tom Brady, he is going to become that great tight end. And he can go places with Tom that he can't go with anyone else. And so Julian Edelman does the same thing. And so these are guys that it's all about the chemistry. And so it's pairing Gronkowski with Brady. It, you know, playing with Belichick for Belichick is hard. There's nothing easy about it, right? And so at some point, some players have had enough. And they have a ring or two or three, and you know they've had enough of that. And so that's not a knock on Bill Belichick. I mean, I think the thing is you realize is that all these players that leave New England, no matter how they leave, they eventually get to the point where they look back and reflect and realize how lucky they were to play there for that coach, for that owner, and with that quarterback. That, you know, they realize that they got to do something that they couldn't do anywhere else. And that's why you don't have players who leave that organization and then look back and criticize and tear down, because that there's a family extension in New England that they all come home. Willie McGinnis and Ty Law and all those guys, they are Patriots for life. And I think that's all part of that culture.
Well, and I think it just goes to show you that winning consistently, it's not going to be easy. It gets tiring, but I mean, it's definitely worth it. So, Jeff, my last question for you is, as far as head coaches and players, and doesn't matter what sport, what's the one takeaway that they can, you know, get from learning about Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, and about this run that the Patriots just had for 19 years or 18 years?
Well, I was very fortunate to have access to Kraft, to Belichick, to Brady, to Bledsoe, to a lot of these players. And one of the reasons that I wrote the book in a way that was that you see the personalities of these guys is because I think it's really important when trying to explain this 20-year run they've been on and the greatness, it's just like trying to explain Tiger Woods. You can't expect to just wake up and say, my son's going to be the next Tiger Woods or the next LeBron James or the next Tom Brady or the next dynasty is going to be here. Because what you realize is that so much of their success is rooted in their personality, the way they're wired and built. And so in New England, what we've seen is this remarkable confluence of three people who come together in the year 2000. Robert Kraft, who hires Bill Belichick, who then drafts Tom Brady. Those three men together, while very different individually as people, they're very different people, they're different guys. But when you put them together, there's a uniqueness there. What they share in common and overrode all their differences was their competitiveness, that killer instinct you talked about, we talked about earlier in this interview with Brady. I think Bill Belichick, who never shows it, this is not a guy who you see ranting and raving on the sideline. Think about basketball coaches, right? They scream at the refs and they do tantrums on the sideline. And you go, wow, that guy's intense. Bill Belichick doesn't do that. This is a guy who, when they kick a field goal to win the Super Bowl with 8 seconds left, shows no emotion at all. It's almost like you wonder, like, does that guy have a pulse? I mean, he doesn't show emotion that way. But my goodness, if you want to talk about someone who has killer instinct, who would do anything to win, Bill Belichick possesses that in spades, and so does Robert Kraft. And so they have a player who they've entrusted the franchise to, Brady, who they know has that. And when you're on the sideline, you hear and see it. Everyone on that field knows there's nobody more competitive, who would do whatever, who would, you know, jump over a pile and expose his back to the incoming helmet of Ray Lewis. That's a pretty tenacious competitor. I mean, that's who Tom Brady is. And then who will get up and in Ray Lewis's face, you know, shout him down. I mean, that's like, there's just, who else does that? I mean, they know they have that guy. I mean, and Brady knows when he looks on the sideline and sees the guy with a headset on, he knows that that guy is just as committed to winning as he is. And they both know when they look up at the owner's box, the guy who's writing the checks, there's nothing more that he wants than to win year after year after year after year. And I think that that's what it takes. Like, you have to have equal determination to do what it takes. And so the coach and the quarterback, they're in the building before everybody else, and they're there longer than everyone else. And here's the thing. You'd say, well, yeah, I get that when they're trying to build the dynasty, but once they get the dynasty built, when you're telling me that the quarterback who's now been there for 15 years and has more hardware than anyone else, he's still the first guy there and the last guy to leave? Wow. I mean, so when you walk into that building as a new free agent that's just signed a contract, or you're the rookie that just got drafted, when you see that that's still the way that Belichick and Brady are, that's pretty intimidating. And it's like, it tells you right away, like, I've either got to be like that or I should go play somewhere else.
Wow. I love this. This was awesome. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it. If you guys haven't checked out his book yet, The Dynasty, it's available wherever books are sold. I would highly, highly recommend it. Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the show and please write another book soon.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It was great talking to you.
All righty.
Perfect. That was a very, very good interview. I didn't want it to stop.
Bro, is it bad for me to say? I mean, it wasn't Hurricanes related, but I have no issue saying this. That was probably our best interview.
Yeah, like I honestly could have gone on another few hours. You know, because every time he'd tell a story, like one, I mean, he did a fantastic job answering questions in depth, you know, and it's like I would ask one question and he would give an incredible, you know, 5-minute answer. And after that answer, I'd all of a sudden have 15 questions about everything he said, you know.
And this guy, like, that's a guy who had access to the greatest coach of all time, the greatest quarterback football player of all time. And perhaps, you know, I think he shed light on, you know, that Robert Kraft might just be the greatest owner in sports history.
Well, I mean, let's not get – I mean, you're making me gag, Marsh.
Dude, I know that so many people hate the Patriots, but, like, it, just reading that book or listening to that interview, you sure as hell better respect them.
Disputing anything you're saying, it's just, like, making me dry heave a little bit.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was saying I don't like to, but if I have to admit Brady's the best, I will, but I would rather chew glass or something.
Oh, God, that was so awesome. And one last thing before we get Mike on the show. When he was talking about Robert Kraft and just how everybody in the system have to be committed, I thought a lot about Blake James.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, like, for an athletic director, it's different because you have so many different sports. But for the University of Miami, you know, football is the sport. And God, it kind of made you jealous of Patriot fans, to be honest.
I mean, if you're an administrator at Miami, there's only two things that you care about. And it's like you health and football. And, you know, if you're the athletic director, then all you care about is football. Right. And really, I mean, I think Julio Frank should care more about football than U Health, honestly.
Yeah, I mean,
because with no football program, there wouldn't be U Health, right?
True, 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 true. Oh God, that was so awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, is our friend Mike ready?
He is ready. Yeah.
Let's get him on.
Mike, what's up, bro?
What's up? Hold on, wait. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you,
Mike. Long time no talk, big bro. What's up?
How you been, man? I'm all right. How you guys been?
I'm good. Just settled back in the old South Florida, so things are good.
Yeah, man. I had fun following your cross country trek there. It was pretty funny.
Yeah. Oh my dude, that was 5 days of hell.
Yeah.
Besides the quick trip I made to the Cowboys Stadium, like the rest of it. I wouldn't wish that. I mean, just 5 days in a van packed with every valuable possession, along with two other people and a dog.
Oh, how the hell did you get inside that stadium?
Got some connections, man. Got some connections.
I forgot who I'm talking to. I'm sorry about
that. Mike, I was thinking about you during our last interview, man. We just interviewed a guy that. Jeff Benedict wrote a book on the Patriots dynasty, and dude, it's like a must-listen interview for any sports fan. It was incredible. Yeah.
I'll be sure to listen to it once you guys drop it, man. Of course.
Yeah.
It was awesome. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. Okay, but let's get to the Canes. 24 hours away. Are we going to break the bye week losing streak?
Yes, the hell we are, and I don't understand the worries behind. Well, I mean, I guess I can say.
Yeah, you can't say that you don't understand the worries.
Yeah, but that I'm not trying to live in last year, man. That's last year. We're 5-1 now. Okay. We're on a 2-game win streak now. Things are different now. The culture seems to be different now. And, you know, coaching staff is different now. So I'm living in the now. And yes, we're going to win. I'm kind of confused as to how the hell the game's going to go, man, because their quarterback is gone. I get it. They give up a lot of yards, and I don't know if I'm expecting a shootout or a blowout. I don't know.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what to expect either. You know, I do think the Wolfpack are a pretty good team, but like you said, you know, they're kind of snake bit right now.
Yeah.
From starting hot, losing their quarterback, losing a game, and then you know, we'll see what happens. I don't really have a projection either. I can tell you that I'm worried about the chunk plays that we give up, but
yeah.
You know, I mean, for the most part, like our defense hasn't been great this season, but they've taken care of business. And I don't know. You guys hear me. Like, I've been worried every week. Like, is this the week that we're just going to fold like a lawn chair? And it hasn't happened yet, besides Clemson. But, that, you know, I'm not going to go into that.
Go ahead, Marsh.
No, I cut you off. Go ahead, brother.
I was going to say that I have grown to – I don't even want to use the word accept, but whatever adjective you want to – put when I finish this thought, I'm that bend but don't break. Listen, it is what it is, man. And that's where we are right now. And at the end, like, what game was it? Was the Pittsburgh game? You know, you look on the TL and everything, everybody, all hell's breaking loose. At the end of the game, they gave up 22 yards on the ground.
Yeah,
it's like. You know, so it's like, well, goddamn, and it just always seems to me like that they bottle it up. What did I miss? It seems like they bottle things up once they get in the red zone, you know. So, look, man, I'm fine with it. It doesn't look picture perfect. Kane's traditional defense, how we're used to, but we're probably never going to see defenses like that again. So,
yeah. So I have a question for you, though, because you're pro defense. Before the season, one of my takes was that this would be our worst defense that we've seen since Manny Diaz got to campus. Is that true so far or no?
Statistically, I think it is, right? I think it is statistically, because they're giving up, what, like 130, I guess, on like somewhere in that vicinity on the ground per game. That's not Manny-ish, right? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I don't even have the stats in front of me, but and then in the air, I think it's pretty much around that, but or what we're used to. But statistically, yeah. But I still think they can get better, man. I don't think. They clearly haven't reached what the hell they can hit. They're not meeting their potential yet. And I just, you know, we got to see how that's going, man.
I have a hot take, and this isn't even a hot take. This defense will not reach its full potential of – I mean, I think this could be an elite defense, like a top 15, top 10 defense, even right. without a guy like Gregory Rousseau. But I don't think defense is going to reach its full potential with Blake Baker as a defensive coordinator. Do you agree or not?
That's for me?
For both of you.
Go ahead, Jordan.
You know, like I don't know if I'm pushing all my chips in on that just yet. But I mean, if you.
George.
Oh, yeah. So you had just said, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I just heard a noise. But anyways, so I think, Marsh, you had said that we're not going to reach our potential with Blake Baker. And that's what. You know, I was about to talk on. I don't know how to feel about Blake yet. I feel like you might be right in that. The, you know, stats and the eye test aren't always – like, they don't always go perfectly together, right? Because our statistics on defense were fine last year, and they're fine again this year. But the optics of this defense just isn't good under Blake. Do you guys get where I'm going with that? Is like, even though I think we finished top 30 last year, it didn't feel like we had a top 30 defense. It didn't feel like our defense is even close to as good as the, you know, the five seasons previous. And that's kind of how I feel about this year too. Like it statistically, there's a lot of areas that it's performing great. But dude, it just doesn't look like the defenses we had when Mark Richt was head coach. So, I mean, maybe you guys can expound on that a little bit, but that's kind of my take on it.
You're going to appreciate this, Jordan, because I'm gonna compare this, and it's gonna be a great comparison. I'm gonna drop a basketball reference. So check this out. There was this huge debate between Stephen A. Smith and Max Kellerman, because Max Kellerman got dogged wrongfully for saying that Kawhi Leonard in the postseason was more clutch than Kobe Bryant. He was absolutely 100% correct, statistically speaking. 1,000% correct. Stephen A. Smith got pissed off. Max got drugged through the mud. And they pulled up a graphic, and everybody had to shut the hell up. So the thing that Max was saying, he was saying, you want to know why people are disagreeing with this and saying, oh, you have no idea what you're talking about? Because Kobe's clutch moments were bigger than Kawhi's, which means that they stood out in your mind more. But when it came down to the last 2 minutes, okay, Kawhi made more buckets, was more efficient from three, from the elbow on in, shot a higher percentage. Everything in the clutch was better than Kobe in the postseason, okay? Now, he wasn't talking about career-wise. He was talking about Kawhi and two seasons ago when they won the NBA championship. He's like, this year's Kawhi is more clutch than Kobe has ever been in the postseason. Yeah. That is 1,000% correct. So I'm making that comparison because maybe it's because we're not seeing 12, 15 tackles for loss a game. Maybe it's because we're seeing 5-6 sacks a game. But just like I said, against Pitt, we allowed – and you're right. It didn't feel like it, because when I looked at the box score, I'm like, we allowed 22 rushing yards? What the hell? Like, wow. Yeah. Like, I didn't – mind you, giving up rushing yards wasn't the thing in that game. It was getting to the quarterback, it seemed like forever, okay? Like, why does he have so much time? Oh, my God. And then, you know, with that – you know, you combine that with – not combine it with, but when that happens, obviously it's harder to keep up with your receiver if you're a guy in the secondary. I will say this, though. Damn it. I had it at the tip of my tongue. What was I going to say? Oh, I forgot what I was listening to or what I was reading that said Blake is trying to let his guys be themselves without him having to give them help. Like, okay, look, I believe our guys are good enough – to get to the quarterback with four. So I'm not going to blitz. I'm not going to blitz unless I really, really have to, or I really, really want to, or we really, really need to right now. And can you blame him for having belief in his guys? Isn't that what a coach is supposed to do? I'm not saying he's right. I'm not saying he's wrong. But, I mean, we know what we're recruiting as fans. The coach is no better. So, you know – gonna bring a fifth guy every now and then, whatever. And then, so I'm not saying you're full of crap, Marsh. I'm saying I'm not ready to pull that trigger yet. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying you're wrong. When I feel that way, but I'm not ready to say that yet.
Okay. And you know, I can appreciate that line of thinking, you know. But there needs to be a balance, right? Like, you can't throw. You know, you can't throw Andy Dalton out there and be like, okay, like, I believe in you, Andy. Like, go out and throw for 400 yards and 5 touchdowns. You know what I mean? Like at some positions, that's going to work.
Hey, that's my
quarterback. But at some positions, it's not going to.
I was waiting for Marsh to say so. I was waiting for Marsh to get defensive.
That's my quarterback, so I'm praying that he can do that.
Right? But that's kind of, you know, that would be my counterpoint to that is, you know, at some positions, that's going to work. Other positions, it's not going to. And you know, like, the argument that you could make is, if that's the attitude and Blake is going out and saying, okay, you know what, we're going to generate a pass rush with only four guys. Well, the problem with that is, on the downs that we don't, like, we struggle on the edges with our corners and with our linebackers at the second level. So the downs that our guys aren't getting elite production, then that puts stress on other position groups that can't handle it. You know, that's why you're seeing the linebackers get exposed so bad, is because it's like, well, you know what? Like, this guy has time to throw, and, you know, like our linebackers just haven't been elite this year. You know, obviously we've seen an uptick having younger guys come onto the field. So I'm not trying to dog them. But you guys get where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know what it comes down to? It's missed tackles. That's one of the biggest things that it comes down to is speed and missed tackles. And I think we have missed so many tackles this year that it's just been so detrimental to our defense, and it pisses me off. And that in that case, it's not Blake's fault. I just feel like this defense, you know, the last two games it has played very, very well, and I think the defense gets kind of a bad rap this year. While they haven't produced as many turnovers as in years past or sacks, you know, all I care about at the end of the day is points allowed. Would you guys agree?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike? I mean, that's you score more points than the other team, then yeah, of course.
Yeah. Like if we can give up 14 points or 19 points, like I will take that every single day, because in years past, those are the kind of games that, you know, even if we do give up 14 points, we still find a way to lose because we can't score points. We don't have that problem now.
Now, Marsh, let me remind you, and no, I am not saying that this is the reason why the defense has been looking at this, but let me remind you that we're probably not going to see that for as long as Lashley's here, because we're running 80 plays on offense. Yeah. The defense is out a lot. So just I had to remind myself of that a couple times this season, even though, just like I said, and I prefaced it with what I just said, that is not the reason why the defense has looked that way. It's because of the offense is in and out. But there are instances where, okay, well, damn, the offense just went three and out or whatever. They scored too quick and the defense is right back out there. So that's something to keep in mind as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe the bad optics are just that we are so confident in this bend don't break thing. And dude, I mean, I know you said that you've like come to terms with it. I just don't know if I can.
Because listen, it was hard. Don't get me wrong, man. I get it. I still have that thing that it's like, give me, where the hell is this? Because I remember, I just turned 37, so I'm a little older than you guys. I remember when Miami giving up 3 yards and 4 yards, like on a rushing play or on any down, was like, what the hell's going on? It was more like 1 yards, 2 yards. Oh, it's 3rd and 8 now.
Yep.
All the time.
Yeah.
It was like that all the time.
Dude, I cannot help but like, you know, just ball my fists and just get so frustrated when I see Pitt's backup quarterback just driving the field on us repeatedly, or UAB's quarterbacks driving the field on us, you know? And that's, I mean, I think that's the optics that I'm having a hard time with, right? Because it's not like we're giving up a ton of points. It's not like we're giving up a ton of yards besides Louisville, you know, but it sucks, you know? No, it does. It sucks seeing these Division II quarterbacks just drive the field on us like we're, I don't know, like we're some high school in New Mexico.
And then, you know, you're right, dude. No, listen, I'm not even going to offer, or I guess I am, do a rebuttal. But then I guess you got to look at the flip and say, well, they adjust after that. And not much is, let me not even say not much, but they do make adjustments after that. And you see some type of improvement throughout the game defensively. But still, I know what you're saying, because you're right. And whoever tries to argue it is just being – they need to shut up and smell the roses.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so we're kind of in the – we're officially pretty much in the – at the halfway point of the season. Let's start with the defense. Mike, who is one player that has surprised you and one player who has somewhat disappointed you and needs to step up in the second half?
Player that has surprised me. I would say Ivy, but I believed in him all along. And after that first game or two games, you haven't heard anything from him in a negative sense. So I would say him, but no. I'll start with disappointed. I'm disappointed in Bradley, because you know how I've always felt about him, Marsh. Yeah, and
that's your boy,
Bradley Jennings. Yeah, man. When he looked good after that first game, I think it was second game. I think it was UAB. He looked really, really good out there. And I was like, thank God, like, this is it, you know, whatever. Then after that, you really it's just kind of, you know, been for naught. But disappointed in that, because of the way he started this, you know, the season had, to me, his best game of his career. And then it hasn't been anything else. And I guess I'll throw Nesta in there, because we did an episode on, well, I did
I was on your show a couple months ago during the offseason, and I said, if you guys remember correctly, we need one defensive tackle to just have a great season for this defense to be it. Doesn't matter who it is, but it should be Nesta, because that's wasn't he like the number one, number two, number three D tackle when we signed him? So I'll say him. I'm not saying he's having a bad year, but he's not having the year we wanted.
He's been up and down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He hasn't been consistent. I mean, you look at the Louisville game, or especially the FSU game, Nesta was a bully, a straight just bully. And I feel like we haven't seen that same production. And I want to make a point to that Bradley Jennings. You know, when you look at UAB's offense, they were very, a very power run oriented offense. And Bradley Jennings suits and McLeod suits better to defending that kind of offense. And since then, you know, you play teams like Clemson and Louisville. Those slow linebackers are going to get exposed.
Yep.
So,
good point. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And so I think it really just depends on the team that you're going up against, you know, which linebackers are going to step up. And so I agree with you on that point. Jordan, what do you think about, you know, one defensive player who, you've been pleasantly surprised with, and also who needs to step up?
You know, it's hard. I'm going to go with a tie for pleasantly surprised. Jared Harrison Hunt. Not that I didn't believe in him. You know, I mean, we heard a lot about him last season, and even coming into the year that, you know, he might pop. But he really has, like, he's revolutionized our defensive line play. He's really solidified the middle of the field for us and gotten great pass rush. And then I also just, you know, I personally was really tough on DJ Ivy after the UAB game. And, I'm happy to eat crow, right? There's nothing that makes me happier than a Miami Hurricanes football player making my opinions look stupid when they're negative, right?
Yeah, man. I hear you.
And so I will scream from the rooftops that DJ Ivy has impressed me so much since that first week. I actually have some stats right here, and I want to share them on the record just to let everyone know how good DJ has been since then. So these are his season stats. He's been targeted 16 times this year. He's only given up 5 receptions for 84 yards and a touchdown. And if you remember, almost all of those yards were in week one. So, I mean, he has been locked down ever since week one.
Yeah.
And then, to go to a guy who's disappointed, I don't know, man. I mean, that's kind of the benefit of being a little pessimistic, is that there's not many guys that can disappoint you, right? I didn't really believe in our linebackers that much. Probably Nesta, I'd say, or maybe Amari Carter. I don't know. Like,
that's who I was going to say.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mind Amari as a player. You know, is he out of position sometimes? Yes. I don't think he's bad. But, dude, you got to stay on the field. Like, you got to use your head a little bit and not to smash in another player's head. Like, you got to, you know.
Use your head.
That's not what it's for. Exactly. So, I don't know. It's probably Amari. We need better decision-making from him. Like, he's the captain, I assume, for a reason. You know, he's a leader on that defense, and he's actually a crucial rotation player for us. So we just need him on the field, man.
Amari, I've said it on the podcast a lot. Amari may not be the best in pass coverage, but there's a reason why he's out there so much. He provides a crucial role to this defense. And when he gets thrown out in the first half, that hurts this defense tremendously. And, you know, I think a lot of people need to ease up on Blake Baker a little bit, because he's had to, you know, play maybe even half the games he's been at Miami for a defensive coordinator pretty much without one of his starting safeties for a majority of the game. And so,
it's so ridiculous, dude. I can't help but laugh.
Saturday Night Live skit.
I know. He's missed more than half the season because of targeting penalties. He hasn't even been hurt.
It pisses me off so much. Okay, let me ask you this. If Miami is to win 10 games in the regular season, if they're to win out or, you know, get 9 wins, who's the one offensive player that needs to step up more? What do you think, Mike?
offensive player, it has to be a receiver. I'll take any receiver. But to answer your question, I'm gonna go. Oh my God, I'm drawing a blank. Not Pope, but his high school teammate. Jesus Christ, Mike. Wiggins, thank you. I'm gonna go Wiggins, and that shows you how probably disappointed I've been with Pope, because for the past 2 years, Marsh knows this, he was my breakout guy. I was obviously wrong with the offensive coordinator that you don't like to name his first year. I was gonna say Pope was his breakout year. I mean, we were all blinded by what the hell didn't happen that year. But then when we got last year, I'm thinking this is the year for Pope. I gotta move on from that. I'm gonna say Wiggins because dude has he's like Lamar Thomas to me. Yeah. Obviously a lot taller, but I think that's a red zone threat. That's a deep ball threat. That's a guy that's supposed to be physical and win jump balls. Underrated blocker. I think it has to be him. I think he has to be the receiver. So that's my guy.
Jordan, what do you think?
This might come across as a hot take, but Derek King. Derek King needs to be better. And don't get me wrong. I am not disappointed with Derek King. I am not I'm not trying to come off as crapping on him or his performance this year. That being said, you guys answer this question. Has he been as good as you expected this year?
No, because the receivers haven't.
Well, I mean, the answer was still no. I mean, you had a qualifier, but I mean, you can see where I'm getting at is we need him to be a little more accurate. This isn't necessarily his fault. I mean, a lot of it will come in play calling, but I think we need him to be a bigger impact player on the ground. Actually, I think we need, more impact plays from his feet. Cause as you've seen, at times that's all we can get going on offense. That's all we could do against Clemson was have De'Aaron King run for big gains. I'm still giving De'Aaron King a passing grade. I'm a big fan of his. I'm happy with his play. I think he needs to up his game to be a little closer to what we were expecting in the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, I running wise, I could definitely see where you're coming from. I know in the UAB game, every time they tried to do a designed run, it didn't go anywhere. So I think, he's had to do all of it off of scrambling. But I definitely see where you're coming from. Mike, do you have a thought on that?
No, that's something that I can't disagree with either. I mean, there are times that are not just me, but a lot of people wish that he's kind of kept it more. And it's to the deep ball. Yeah, a little bit more accurate. Forgot who I was talking to that he said that. Who was it? I think it was Art. Yeah, it was Art from 305sports.net. He made a good point. He was saying, look, man, when Lassie was over at SMU last year, he had a lot more confidence in his receivers because he was always going down the field and they were making plays one-on-one contested 50-50 balls. And maybe part of the reason that we're not seeing that many plays downfield is because he kind of sees the problem that everybody else sees with the receivers, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And for a quarterback that isn't getting a chance to throw the ball downfield that much, I mean, you could practice it all you want. In-game reps are the best thing. So until it starts to happen consistently, it's probably not going to be probably not going to see that. I don't know. Maybe it sounds like I'm making an excuse, but I'm just going by something that made sense to me when Art brought it up.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm not trying to dog on how Derek.
No, you're not.
The question was who needs to step up and play better if we get 10 wins? Now, going 10-1 is not going to be easy, right? We're still going to play Virginia Tech and UNC. I think both those games will be a dogfight. I don't think those are easy wins by any stretch. To keep that consistency week in and week out, I really think De'Aaron King needs to play closer to a Heisman level than what we've seen.
Yeah, for sure. Because, I mean, that's exactly what he was coming in. I mean, a lot of guys had him as a – I don't even want to say Heisman dark horse. He was in the favorite. Running.
Yeah, he was second. Second best odds.
Weeks, yeah. After 3 weeks, De'Aaron King was a true Heisman candidate.
Yeah.
Damn. Damn, that kind of makes me sad. We could have had a Heisman Trophy winner.
Hey, we don't get nice things, man.
Mars, to go back to what you were saying about, you know, the guys that have surprised you on the defense, it popped up when I was hearing you guys talk and I didn't say it. And it's surprised in a sense that it happened this late, because I think a lot of people expected it, but to Corey, man, to Corey Couch, yep. that dog, mentality, he's playing through it, man. He's really exemplifying what Deion Sanders actually said about him in the Under Armour practices, because Deion called him a dog amongst other coaches.
And I was a man that I doubted Couch just because he is so small.
Yeah.
And like I will never forget seeing him last year in fall camp. I'm like, did they let like a South Broward JV player come and practice with the Canes one day? Like he was so small, but he is locked down.
Yeah, man.
And I would honestly say that a strength of our team that not a lot of people are saying right now is our cornerbacks. Like, I think they've been playing surprisingly well. I think Blades and Ivy have held their own in some cases. So, yeah, Couch is – and I think we all kind of expected Couch to, you know, have a little bit bigger role this year. And so that is, you know, one thing that is great to see. Talking about Rhett Lashley's offense – have you been, you know, has it been underwhelming to you, or has this offense performed, you know, right around where you expected it to be?
Go ahead, Jordan.
Sorry, I was responding to a text message. Would you go, Mike?
Sure. I mean, look, the magic number this year was what, 30? Marsh?
Yeah, I'd say so.
So we're averaging, what, 32, right, if I'm not mistaken? I think that's the number. I think the last time I checked, we were averaging 32 a game. And so I guess I can say it's right about where I did expect more in terms of consistency and, I guess, more wide open, you know, explosive play. Not that we haven't had explosive plays. I mean, that's the name of our offense. We're a boom or bust offense. We rarely drive the field. But I didn't think we'd be seeing so many RPOs. I didn't think we'd be seeing that many. I love the formations. I love his ability to see something, communicate with King and, you know, go. We saw that against FSU. We saw that against Louisville. We saw that in a bunch of instances where he sees something from the sideline, you see King check to him, and boom, it's a big play. So I love that. But I didn't think we'd see so many RPO. I'm not complaining about it, because our offense is balanced. Even when the running game isn't working, I love that. I'm not the guy to complain when, oh my God, why are we running up the middle? We keep getting 2 yards. You need that. And people don't freaking understand it because they're stupid, but we need that. Okay. Well, we really do.
And just to go off of that, I saw a lot of people after the UAB game complaining about how much we ran the ball. And, you know, we did run the ball a lot that game, but we ran the ball for 330 goddamn yards.
If it's not broke, right, don't fix it, idiots.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry, Jordan. Go ahead, man.
Oh, you're fine, man. So, like, I guess I've had a harder time assessing, you know, what I expected. And part of that is because I think we all came into the season assuming that our personnel was a lot better than SMU's last year. And I talked about this a few weeks ago on the podcast. Like, I was at Buffalo Wild Wings watching a Ravens game and saw James Prochet catch a ball for him. And then it hit me. I was like, oh, shoot. Like, maybe our personnel isn't as good as SMU's was last year. Cause I mean, Shane Bouchel is good. You know, James Prochet is catching footballs on Sunday, you know, for the Baltimore Ravens, who could go to the Super Bowl. Like, maybe we overestimated our personnel. And well, so,
I have a thought on that.
And so going down this same line of thinking, it's making me wonder if my expectations were wrong before the season. You know, because we kind of expected, wow, like, look what Rhett Lashley can do with an SMU roster. Uh-huh. And we tried to extrapolate it out. Well, we're this much more talented than the Mustangs are, so we should have this much better than the 7th-ranked offense. And, you know, like, maybe that just wasn't right. Who knows?
Well, I think part of that, and I have to make this quick because I have to go on another show in 5 minutes, but I think a part of that is that was Lashley's second season, you know, at SMU. I think players, I mean, in their first season, the offense was still efficient, but it was obviously wasn't efficient to the extreme that they were Lashley's second year at SMU. So I think that plays into it a little bit. But I absolutely think that we overrated our personnel. I think that in the first season, you are going to see a lot of players that maybe don't fit into the system as well as we thought. And I think the second year, and I'm pretty positive Lashley will come back in 2021. Yeah. I think we'll see it'll be a lot more efficient when he comes back next season.
That, and I know you got to go, Marsh, but really quick. Yes, I think that we maybe did over whatever the offense, maybe put a little bit too much stock in them. But I think, too, they had a lot more experience together, like the actual players. Forget Lashley, but there's a lot more seniors and third-year guys on that team than, you know, I think right now. And I think, I mean, experience is a big deal, man, in every sport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, so last question for everyone. Give me the MVP for tomorrow night's game and the score prediction. Michael, start off with you.
Oh, Jesus Christ, man. the MVP for tomorrow's game, I'm going to go with King. He's supposed to be the best player on the team, man. And especially on the offense. So I'm going to go with him as the MVP of the game. And a score prediction, Miami is going to eclipse 30. I'll say 34 to NC State's 24.
Okay.
Okay. So for my MVP, I'm going to say Don Chaney breakout game. I think, you know, he's kind of been getting some buzz as, you know, perhaps he's our best back right now. I think he dumps a gallon of gasoline onto that talk. And I think we win 27-17.
All right. Okay. Very close.
Let's see if I know you as well as I think I do, Marsh. Go ahead.
So I am going to go with Mike. I'm going to say Derek King. I'm also co-MVP. I'm going to say Mike Harley. I think Mike Harley has another big game like he did last game against Virginia. Score prediction, I'm going to say 27-20 Canes.
Okay, fair enough. I thought you were going to say Brevin because he's going to come back pissed off.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully he's playing. I mean, we still don't know who is out because of COVID. So yeah. That is a very, very scary thought. But okay, hopefully, you know, we're all correct on our score predictions. Canes win. Mike, we need to freaking link up soon because I'm down here.
Yeah, man, we do. Hey. And it's going to be leg day.
send me a picture when you guys hang out. I'll be jealous.
Absolutely, absolutely. It won't be during leg day. But okay. Mike, thank you so much for coming on as always, brother. And any closing thoughts from either of you guys?
Ah, man, keep up the good work. Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure. I love doing this with you guys, man.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. We love having you on. Jordan, any closing thoughts?
Nah, man, just the old go Canes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you to Jeff and also to Mike. And let's get a big W tomorrow so we can be happy on a reaction show. Go Canes as always, boys.
Go Canes.
This has been the Forza Podcast. Remember to like,